Welcome to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Today it's time for some big changes on Triad Arts Up Close. First, we go paperless with Sika's Stephen Maticio and a farewell to his award-winning exhibition. Only 2 weeks left to see it. Next, we go public with Winston-Salem Theater Alliance and the Best Little Whorehouse. Then, Carol Rowan is coaching dulcet tones from even the most tonally challenged among us. And pianist Peter Karoff gets romantic with a look at that era's telltale traits. UNCG is throwing a collage concert in Greensboro that's sure to rock your world. And the Monty is back and badder than ever tonight in Carrboro with storytelling from the hilarious to the tragic and everything in between. Next on Triad Arts Up Close. One of the world's leading art magazines, Art Forum, has written glowingly about its exhibitions. Its curator of contemporary art has won the prestigious Emily Hall Termain Exhibition Award and was recently chosen from an international field of candidates to take part in curatorial residencies in Gwangju, South Korea, and Berlin, Germany. So, is it MoMA in New York? How about the National Museum of Modern Art at the Centre Pompidou in Paris? Nope, it's the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and its award-winning curator, Stephen Maticio. On Sunday, September 16th at 5 o'clock, Sika will be closing its acclaimed Paperless exhibition. This free exhibition gathers works made of paper by 15 international artists. It was conceived and curated by my guest, Sika's curator of contemporary art, Stephen Maticio. Stephen, congratulations on the Emily Hall Termain Exhibition Award for Paperless, and this is already getting great press before it even comes to the Triad.
Yeah, I'm a big booster of the Termain Foundation because I actually won this award in 2010, and so the project had even been in development before that time, but they gave me this tremendous platform to really realize it to my grandest dreams. And the Termain, every 2 years, it awards three curators from a national field. You apply for this for a major project that you think breaks new ground in the discourse of contemporary art. And so I think that they really saw the potential of the way that this show mattered, not only in art history, but really the way it connected with the Southeast and Winston-Salem and the way that North Carolina is trying to re-envision itself through creative industries and sort of moving away from a material past. And so I think they saw that confluence of exhibition concept, city, site, culture, context, and all of those things coming together. And yeah, I can't thank them enough because it really has given me the platform to realize this to its maximum potential.
We referenced this earlier, the out of fashion exhibit. Were you using some elements of that into your presentation of this particular project in terms of that coming to grips with the past and moving forward?
Definitely, yeah, because I was thinking about textiles, tobacco, furniture, all of these staples that North Carolina had really been built upon, and the way that as we move forward, we're sort of moving into these intangible industries, biotech research, creative industries, sort of moving into this dematerialized future. And so I thought a lot about paper as this ubiquitous antiquity, something that's all around us that we use as this vehicle to remember and how to remember, and yet everything that's pushing us towards progress has become synonymous with paperless. Whether it's the environment or the economy, everything is about shedding our connections to this material, this heavy archive, and moving into this much more fluid realm. And I was curious about what is gained and what is lost in that transition, you know, from the simplest page to thinking about it in industrial and economic and cultural terms.
I think what I'm finding is just the variety of shapes, textures, and size elements, too, from the smallest origami-like figure to these enormous canvases of paper. It's really limitless.
That's what I love about this show. You'll see all across the scale. So you'll see very minute pieces. There's an artist named Nava Lubelski who's based out of Asheville, and she's shredded old rejection letters, tax forms, love letters, and then turned them into little ribbons, which then she does this sort of neo-quilling operation. And so they all become little cells in these amoeba-like growths that just continue to sort of spread and kind of move across the gallery space. And then you get an artist like Doug Copeland of Generation X fame who actually chews all the pages of his novels to pulp them as wasps would and then turns them into these nests to think about our connection with information and really this umbilical connection with information. And then we go all the way up to the large scale. We've got new commissioned pieces by an Armenian artist named Karen Sargsyan and an American artist named Natasha Bowden, who are creating these beautiful sort of Natasha works in these kind of lyrical organic flows of paper ribbons, all referencing Walt Whitman, Lewis Carroll, really famous authors, and this new take on magic realism. And then Karen creates these sort of Baroque, decadent royal court scenes falling apart at the seams, the sort of the grand party before the grand finale. And so I just love that. Yeah, the way that this exhibition will really move you across the way that paper is very intimate experience for us, as well as collecting the archive of human thought and human culture. So I really wanted to move across that spectrum.
Moving across that spectrum with how many artists? And this is an enormous exhibit.
Yeah, this is 15 people, and 15 people that are contributing quite a bit to this show. And it really ranges from all corners of the world. So we've got artists from Armenia, from Ecuador, from China, from Copenhagen, Denmark, really across the board, Canadians that have grown up in South Africa. I wanted to have this as global a conversation as possible. So not just looking at a particular Western philosophy or an Eastern philosophy, but really looking at the confluences, the comparisons, the overlaps, the differences, and the way that paper circulates, its symbolic importance within various cultures as well.
It seems so appropriate to me because we're at a global precipice in terms of the shift away from, just reading an article the other day about the death of money.
Yeah.
And it's on the horizon within the next several years.
Well, you raise an excellent point, because actually an inspiration point was an article when I was back home in Canada for one Christmas. I saw this article about the Canadian government moving its currency from paper to this synthetic material that's actually a plastic hybrid. And this got me so inspired that we're now going to print the catalog for this exhibition on this same material. So it's sort of this non-paper, this memory, and yet this complete phantom of what paper was. And so I was really interested, you're right, in the way that that kind of movement is circulating in every sphere of our culture.
I wonder, too, if you're tapping into an inner longing for that medium, even though some segments revile it as something you just have to recycle and remake, otherwise you feel guilty about it. But yet there's an attraction to it.
You've got it. Like there's very strong currents of nostalgia in this show. But I think that they're well-founded. I think that, like, for me in particular, some of the research I was doing was that paper is not only about the content of what we want to remember, it's also of remembering how we want to remember. In that when people hold paper, they think that we engaged with this information in a very linear and concentrated and dedicated way. When we think about engaging with digital information, it's sort of about attention deficit disorder and always an influx and overwhelming. And I think that people sort of look back longingly at paper as this time that we really read things carefully and that we really remembered things and we wrote things down and they had a more material presence. And even if that's completely imagined and romanticized and utopian, I think that people hold on to paper as that way of remembering, of romanticizing a way of remembering. And for me, that's really interesting as we move into different eras of the information age, from print and paper to this digital frontier where everyone is sort of reorganizing at once.
When you reference nostalgia, I think of the word anticipation, and anticipating that letter and the feeling associated with that is something that you really can't. I mean, waiting for that email, it's just not the same.
You're right. There's this really strong component of time, and there's an artist named Kyle Johnson. His father was a small town newspaper publisher in Kansas City, and so he grew up with the smell and the noise and the texture of print. And he creates this piece in the exhibition called Publish or Perish. And it's kind of this Darwinist self-portrait, this Rube Goldberg-like contraption that imitates a printing press. And as it weaves this paper through, it's actually a drawing of his called Everything I Own. And it's this sort of life going through all the travails, all the trials of print and growing up with print. And he sort of looks longingly at the communication technologies of old and how they carried our stories in a particular way and how they might be carried into the future.
My thanks to Southeastern Center for Contemporary Arts, curator of contemporary art, Stephen Matisio.
You just have 2 weeks left to see this remarkable exhibit. On Sunday, September 16th at 5 o'clock, CECA will be closing paperless to make way for the new. On September 14th at 7 o'clock, CECA presents its new opening, the exhibition Ann Kessler Shields, a 50-year retrospective. Will celebrate the artist's career through January 6th, 2013. Organized by CECA and guest curated by Tom Patterson, the opening is free with cash bar and light refreshments served as well. You can enjoy a tour of both exhibitions conducted by Stephen Maticio himself during CECA's first ever fundraiser tea, Sunday, September 16th at 2 o'clock. Seating is limited to 36 guests, and you'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and now from an art exhibition that's free and open to the public to a public offering of a very different sort. The Best Little Whorehouse Goes Public, the hilarious sequel to that other whorehouse musical, is filled with witty, spirited songs and a book that pokes fun at society's political and sexual hypocrisy. The Winston-Salem Theater Alliance goes public beginning Friday night, September 14th at 8 o'clock at the Theater Alliance building on Northwest Boulevard in Winston-Salem. Actors Kenneth Ashford, who plays Senator Harry Hard-Est, and Gesh Metz, who plays the role of former Best Little Whorehouse Madame Mona Stangley, drop by WFDD to talk with me about it. Well, this is coming up. The Best Little Whorehouse Goes Public is the first show of the 29th season. That's huge. What's new with the theater?
Well, we've been in our space now for about, what is it, 4 or 5 years now? And it's sort of, now we've settled in, it's comfortable, it's home.
Yeah.
We're always having new things being done to the theater, though. We've got some wonderful new curtains. Curtains were a bit of a problem for us for a long time. We've got some beautiful new curtains, and we're just trying to keep it fresh and new as possible. And
okay.
We're doing a lot of shows all the time. We have more guests coming in. For example, a couple weeks ago, Del Shores, who wrote the play Sordid Lives, which is one of our most popular plays, he came in and brought his one-man comedy show with him. So there's always, even when the Theater Alliance, the theater company, isn't in the theater, we have other people coming in, and I think we're doing more of that this year, which is nice.
Great.
The big thing about this year is that we're really focusing on giving back to the community. So a lot of our shows, for example, our staged readings, generally they will go toward the profits, or donations will go to some worthy cause in the area.
A staged reading, for those not in the know, talk me through that.
What is it, really, or what do we do? A staged reading, typically the actors are on book and read from the script, but Jamie usually pushes us pretty hard. I just did a staged reading of a musical, Having Our Say, and it celebrated older Americans, and Jamie has us trying to do choreography and everything. So it was a lot of fun. The proceeds went to the Shepherd's Center, and I think that was a nice donation to them.
Oh, that's nice. So it's not just staying in the reading your thing. You're actually
No, there's actually – and it's amazing when you see them, because you think, well, if I go see a group of actors performing with the script in their hand, it's going to be very distracting. But it's amazing how quickly you forget that they're – or you don't notice that they're carrying a script with them.
Yeah.
And you get caught up in the play almost as much as you would as if it were a full-scale production.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've experienced that too.
Yeah.
Well, you all have appeared together. You were husband and wife in Looking for Normal. Is that
yes.
correct? How does that help you in terms of future performances together?
I've done several shows with Ken. I think starting with the first Whorehouse was our first show together.
Right.
And Looking for Normal was the one we probably really had to work the most with each other. It's just a sense of trust and confidence. You can tell when somebody you've worked with like that is going to go up and try to help out, and you can trust them to try new things. And I know that if something's not really working for Ken, he'll pull me aside later and go, can we tweak that a little bit?
It gives me a sense of comfort to know that I'm working with someone who I've worked with before, because I know that if I go up on a line and I forget, I have a look in my eyes, apparently, that Gesh will pick up.
It's a mirror. It reflects mine.
So that's always comforting.
Yes, I'm the man in New Orleans. You have to know I'll toe the line. I'm so full of self-respect. I'll keep your standards just like mine. Let's keep it up. Let's see it through. Don't rest if it's nothing left to do. Gotta get down and dirty, and you gotta fight me. I have to say
guess, working with middle school students, what do you miss most about that dynamic? Because you're no longer teaching.
I miss diagramming sentences, David. You don't get to do that in real life, and it's one of the few things I can do. And I miss my seventh graders from last year. And
diagramming those sentences at parties, it's kind of a buzzkill.
No,
you get your beer tricked, and then, oh, there goes Gash again. Yeah, the blackboard. Put the blackboard away, Gash. Full of money. Yes, I'm the man whom you elect. You have to know. Now, this is the sequel to The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, but the returning character, Mona Stangley.
S-T-A-N-G-L-E-Y.
Tell me about Mona. What kind of gal is she?
Mona is above and beyond anything a realist. She understands that prostitution isn't pretty, but it's going to happen. And if it's going to happen, then it ought to be controlled. Somebody should make a profit. It should be fair. It should be regulated. It shouldn't be dirty. So she has standards that once you get past that initial idea, she's okay with it.
She's true to that belief system through and through. She's
very, very much so.
Solid citizen. Can you set the scene in the courtroom? How does this come about?
This is actually in a Senate hearing where my character, Senator Hard-Assed, with a T at the end.
Yes, of course.
Is grilling Ms. Mona about her involvement with a whorehouse where there's being stock sold in it as a public corporation. He, of course, is a morally upright just senator, and he can't abide this going on.
But it's in Nevada, and it's legal.
By golly, it is legal, isn't
sure.
it?
Sure. All right.
And what goes on there stays there.
Senator, I thought the issue at hand was our going public in a legal business, but it's hardly been mentioned.
All right, Missy, let's begin with your qualifications to be an official of an investment corporation doing business with Wall Street and the American public. What do you know about money, about high finance?
Well, I imagine I'm at least as qualified as certain individuals who have spent our country into bad debt and left bills for our grandchildren.
The clerk will strike that impertinence.
I admit I have no experience at all when it comes to busting budgets, spending money I don't have, or voting myself pay raises. And I admit I don't have big corporations lining up with airplanes to fly me here and yonder for free.
Such blasphemy will be stricken from the record.
All I know is to be fair with people and not hurt anybody if I can help it. Those are my qualifications,
this
Senator.
This witness has been hostile, evasive, and non-responsive. She has put on notice this distinguished committee will consider contempt charges, and she is forthwith dismissed.
That's great. A little politics just in time for...
just in time. Just when you thought you'd heard all the political ads you need.
Hopefully taking some of the edge off and having a lot of fun with it.
This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and I've been speaking with Winston-Salem Theater Alliance actors Kenneth Ashford and Gesh Metz. We'll be back for part two of our interview about The Best Little Whorehouse Goes Public after this short break. Then, have you ever been called tone deaf? Well, don't throw in the towel on your tune-making just yet, because vocal educator Carol Rowan is here to save the day next when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Winston-Salem Theater Alliance actors Kenneth Ashford and Gesh Metz about the new production of The Best Little Whorehouse Goes Public. It opens tonight at 8 o'clock on the Winston-Salem Theater Alliance stage in Winston-Salem.
Mona Stangley, you're a hard woman to track down.
Bonnie and Clyde had their reasons for hiding, and I got mine.
This show is heavy in costumes. A lot of Theaterland shows have costume changes. This may be among the most difficult. I think we have people who are figuring, how am I going to get from there to there and change costume in that small amount of time? So it's going to be fun.
I think I have 8 changes myself, so...
How many people are in the show?
At least 15, I would think.
I was going to say 20.
Somewhere between 15 and 20.
Yeah. The show itself, it's a sequel to The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. What happens? Where do we pick up?
Best Little Whorehouse ends, doesn't it, with the whorehouse closing down? The chicken
right.
Ranch.
It kind of has a downward trajectory. And at the end, Mona's love interest has not stood by his woman. And it's kind of a...
The chicken ranch closes.
Yeah. So we start right down there. Mona's now working as a waitress. If you kind of picture Mel's Diner.
Yeah.
And she's at a low point in her life. She's really let herself slide. And she's approached by a young up-and-coming IRS agent. The IRS has closed down and taken over Stallion Fields, a legal brothel, because they kind of forgot that they had to pay taxes.
It happens.
Well, the IRS certainly doesn't know what to do with a brothel, so they send a lackey, a toady, in to do whatever. And she decides she can make it profitable, but she does need help.
Now, this brothel is not in Texas, though. This is in?
Las Vegas.
Las Vegas.
Okay.
So she approaches Mona Stangley. She tracks her down and finds her and says, oh, I want you to come out here and manage this brothel. And Mona says, well, it sounds better than going to them Prostitution Anonymous meetings.
Prostitution Anonymous. I love it. Your nemesis in this is sitting across from me here, I'm assuming. We're talking about Senator Harry Hardass. I saw a little clip from your political ad there, Senator. I must say, little severe, but I've seen this person before.
He's a typical what many people believe in politics are. He's what you might call a hypocrite. He's sort of he's self-righteous, self-important. He sees himself as the guardian of the nation's morals. And yet, you know, he's got little things on the side that go totally against what he's all about and his public image anyway. And that's always a rich area for satire when people are such hypocrites, particularly politicians, which is why we think it will resound well in this season.
Houston, goodbye, Dallas. Goodbye, and as always, with this, just like with the original, music is the key. By Carol Hall.
Carol Hall is the music again. There's, I think, much more music in this than in the original Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. And it's almost 80-90% upbeat, fun, hoedown dancing, really memorable songs that stay in your head.
There's a wonderful little like 40s number called Call Me. So it's glitzied up, and it's not just a bunch of twangy country music.
Along the lines of the upbeat, though, I'm Leaving Texas just sounded like a real rabble-rousing tune, but not maybe the easiest song. A lot of challenges there. How's that one going?
It's going well because it scared me so badly.
The lyrics come fast and furious on that one, and it's very difficult. I unfortunately am not in that number, so I got to sit back and watch these very talented young actors in the chorus, and of course, Gash, getting their mouths around these words while dancing. The tempo's boom, 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 boom. It's a lot of fun. It's a great number to start the show.
Tell me about how you prepare a tune like that.
I have to, I mean, my personal way of getting it is to hear it and hear it a lot. Now for someone hears this song and that's us. I'm leaving Atkins, Aiden, now a soda, nickel freak and clue. But I started listening to this song back in March and April and just hearing it over and over again. It lists every significant town in Texas and in an auctioneer kind of format. So I'd never heard of most of these towns, but I know now.
The Best Little Whorehouse goes public, not necessarily for the kids.
No, not at all. Theater Alliance has a bit of a reputation for doing adult shows. Not all of them are. This one is one of them, however.
Okay. Well, Senator, I understand you're the incumbent. What can we look forward to in a second term?
Well, my concern as a God-fearing, scripture-spouting, totally monogamous public servant and guardian of the nation's morals is to make sure that people like Ms. Mona Stangley don't corrupt our youth with her vileness and promiscuity.
Oh, you convinced me. I'm blushing.
All right. I'm channeling any number of... Actually, I don't know who I'm channeling, but it's such a stereotype. It's wonderful to just go overboard with it.
My thanks to Winston-Salem Theater Alliance actors Kenneth Ashford and Gesh Metz. The hilarious musical is The Best Little Whorehouse Goes Public, and it opens Friday night, September 14th at 8 o'clock at the Theater Alliance building on Northwest Boulevard in Winston-Salem. It'll run through the 23rd with Sunday matinees at 2, and you'll find links to ticket information and more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and next, it's time to sing. Even if you couldn't carry a tune with handles on it. Why? Because my next guest says so. That's why. Carol Rowan is an Indiana University graduate where she earned a master's degree in vocal performance. After years of performances in opera and oratorio throughout the Northeast, Carol began teaching voice in 1970. Her students have ranged from soprano Amanda Pabian to the indie rock band The Cobbs to singer-songwriter Ryan Tennis.
So come wake me up in the shady summer air.
Carol's series of six classes titled Singing for the Tone Deaf begins Monday, October 15th at the Center for Musical Excellence at Salem College. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And in the meantime, here's Carol. I'm really interested in the fact that you've worked with musicians from such a broad spectrum, from indie rock to coloratura soprano. Are there concerns or challenges that are universal across the disciplines? And then are those others I'm curious about that are specific to the rock singer versus the...
Yes. Well, I work with them all the same way. I mean, I've worked with Down syndrome, Asperger's, autism, Alzheimer's, and I use the same exercises for everybody because I think if you're using the greatest amount of your body, the vocal possibilities, then whatever style you use to actually perform with, you know, you've got a lot in reserve. It's sort of, you know, like training to run faster in practice so that you know you've got that in reserve. One of the great issues about bands is that they don't always play together. When I first came here, there was a band playing at the garage. You could have said a metronome. They were all playing on the same beat, but they were not playing together. They were not using that sphere, okay, for each other either, and you can tell the difference.
The emotional impact isn't there because they seem like five guys playing in their own little practice rooms.
Absolutely. They're doing their own thing.
Yeah. And that's why when you hear the opposite of that, it just can be so spellbinding.
Yes, it is.
Across all these different disciplines, we're talking about, for the most part, professional singers who obviously have a great sense of pitch to begin with. They're great workings to start off with, have developed a good sense of relative pitch. I thought it was really interesting when you first contacted me, this whole concept of really addressing those without good relative pitch, or that the class is titled Singing for the Tone Deaf
classes. In quotes.
In quotes. Carol, could you speak to some of the pain that people go through when they've been classified as being, you know, quote, tone deaf?
Yes. Well, there's one thing. They get classified around second grade because the common wisdom is that by second grade, you should have developed this skill, which everybody has, because little kids, the world around, go nya, 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 with no problem at all. But to have someone play a note, let's say on the piano or the violin or something, and say, now repeat that, that particular skill is, it's a developmental thing, but it has a very broad range in terms of age when it's developed. And then you get classified. You get told to stand in the back row and just move your mouth. It's just like being told you're dumb. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So one thing they do is to stop trying. And it's sad because singing probably came, evolutionarily speaking, before speech. And their reasoning is that singing uses more of the vocal mechanism than speech does. Therefore, it probably originated first, which is really an exciting idea.
What's happening physiologically to shut that, what should be a natural ability down?
When you're young and somebody says, try harder, what do? You squeeze up something because that's what you know to do, to try harder. And when they squeeze up the muscles around the ear to listen harder.
Shutting it down.
Yeah, shutting it down. And over the last, let's say, 10 years or so, I've observed that some of the people who have been classified as tone deaf were classified that way because they actually have a stronger sense of pitch in some maybe off-the-wall kind of way.
Oh, I fed my child on the good land. Oh, we burn the oil, we burn the ash.
I'm working now with somebody who his wife would never let him sing because he sang a third below the pitch.
When you say a third below, we're talking about an interval. Yeah. On the keyboard, you'd go down three white notes from
yeah,
a note
yeah,
and
yeah, yeah,
a
yeah.
third lower than the real note. It's harmonizing, essentially.
Yeah. And I had someone else who came to me because her siblings had teased her unmercifully about that she couldn't carry a tune. And with her, I discovered one day when she had actually switched the resonance chambers around. So she was missing a couple of overtones and thought she was off pitch.
Well, resonances and overtone series for the non-musician, you have to break that terminology down for.
Well, really, the whole body is an instrument, a resonance chamber. If you think of it like a violin or a guitar, that's what your body is. And process I go through is opening it up, seeing how much room we have in there for the sound waves to bounce around in, and then they bounce someplace else and reinforce themselves. When I talk about overtones, way back in Pythagoras' time, he discovered that there were actually other sounds that could be perceived that had a mathematical relationship, actually, to the original tone. Those are called overtones.
But this student who had what you might describe as a traditionally weak sense of pitch actually had an acute sense of awareness of these overtones.
Yes, and also if a note is played on the piano, a really musically intelligent person knows that they can't repeat that sound. They don't sound like a piano.
I'm sure it's very different from student to student, but then again, you mentioned there's a template that you do use.
Yeah.
Put me in that studio with you for a minute, and how do you go about breaking down some of these barriers?
Well, I never tell them they're wrong. Let's say at the very beginning, I only point out when they're on the right pitch. And I constantly tell them, oh, that doesn't matter. Don't worry about the pitch. We'll get there. And so a lot of that, of course, is just building confidence that this is something that they can do. And I work a lot on the body, body consciousness. So if, when they begin to feel how, oh, yeah, I can feel my throat open there. Oh, I get it. It's supposed to be open. Then they're concentrating on something else, and they're free to be on pitch instead of trying to be on pitch. If you can recognize your mother's voice on the phone, and you can tell whether she's happy or sad, you're not tone deaf.
My thanks to voice and stage presence educator Carol Rowan. Her research into the physiology of the voice and more than four decades of vocal instruction have led Carol to work with various vocal problems. Singing for the Tone Deaf, with Tone Deaf in quotes, begins Monday, October 15th at the Center for Musical Excellence at Salem College. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and we'll take another short break now, but then it's time to get romantic with our good friend Peter Karoff at the keyboard. Just what makes the romantic period so great? We'll find out next when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and this is Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the keyboard.
Today I'd love to talk with you about a period in music history we call the Romantic Era. It's basically the 19th century, from about 1800 until about 1900. That word romantic is a little bit unusual, actually. Romantic, in modern sense, we think, oh, isn't it romantic? It's all about love. But the word romantic actually has a broader sense in this context. It comes actually from the French roman, which is the French word for a novel. And so when we say this music is romantic, we're saying that it is literary. It's like today we say, wow, isn't it just like the movies? It's so intense. Well, back then they said, isn't it like a book? It's so intense. So we can understand this music through the 19th century as being deeply influenced by and inspired by literature. So, for example, here's a piece by Felix Mendelssohn. It's from one of his Songs Without Words. Well, it's beautiful. It has a melody. It has an accompaniment. So in its expression and in its rich harmonies, yes, it's romantic. It's characteristic of the 19th century. But there's another layer to this piece. Mendelssohn calls it the Venetian boat song. And so suddenly we're invited to imagine not just that it's a melody and an accompaniment, but it's also a scene, a story. There's a boatman, and we're in Venice, and we're in a gondola, and the melody in the right hand is now a gondolier singing. And the accompaniment in the left hand is not just beautiful harmonies, but the rocking waves of the boat as we sit in the gondola. The music's so beautiful and so filled with emotion that we're tempted to imagine a story that's being told. What is happening here? Well, the answer to that question most of the time is simply this. That is to say, what's happening is the notes. And yet, in the Romantic era, in the 19th century, people were constantly telling stories through sound. Overtly or less overtly, but nevertheless, there is a kind of literary component to so much of the instrumental music of this period. Another important component we see in the 19th century was a move towards instrumental virtuosity. That's a fancy word. It just means requiring more from performers. A virtuoso is simply someone who's really good at their instrument or their voice. And so virtuosity demands a richer and grander approach to the keyboard and to the other instruments than was required before. You can hear those rich harmonies, the dramatic movements of the melodies going here and there. Powerful use of the instrument, this kind of virtuosity. So whether it's a simple piece like the Mendelssohn we heard earlier, a thick, powerful, and virtuosic work like this piece by Johannes Brahms, a quiet and thoughtful interlude like this one by Schumann, they're all perfect examples of this musical romanticism, seemingly telling a story through sound, pushing the emotional content so that we feel what the composer is trying to express. We feel those moments of pathos and of passion and of joy. Quite often these works require an extensive ability, a technical ability, so that the instruments are used in a much more flashy way. Musical romanticism. Thank you.
Isn't that romantic? Pianist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Karoff helping us all understand classical music just a little bit better. I'm David Ford, and this is Triad Arts Up Close. Next, it's romantic, classical, jazz, electronic, and much more at UNCG. Imagine setting your iPhone to shuffle mode and experiencing it live. Next, add dance, visual arts, along with lighting design elements, stagecraft, and a human surround sound system like you've never experienced. That's the University of North Carolina Greensboro's annual Collage Concert, and it'll be Saturday, September 8th at 7:30 in Acock Auditorium on the UNCG campus. The best part is, proceeds from this dynamic concert mix showcasing the breadth and quality of the school goes towards scholarship funding for talented students who otherwise might not have been able to attend UNCG. Associate Director of Bands and Director of Orchestral Activities Kevin Giraldi and Assistant Professor of Choral Music Carol Ott drop by WFDD to talk about Collage 2012. How many years have you been doing what you're doing at UNCG?
Eight years.
This
is my eighth year. And my position is really unique in how many different things that I'm doing, from the orchestra side of things, the wind conducting side of things, teaching conducting. It gives me many avenues where I can do new music, a lot of new commissions, contemporary music, especially with the wind ensemble, as well as the standard repertoire that I grew up loving and experiencing in the orchestral side of things. So I feel really fortunate to be able to have that opportunity to do all those things.
Yeah.
Very early on, I had the good fortune of attending York High School, which is a really fantastic high school outside of Chicago, in the Chicago suburbs. And my sophomore year of high school, we commissioned a piece from Donald Erb, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. And I was able to participate in the process of working with him in the draft process of the piece, performing the first performance. He came to rehearsals. He looked at some little pieces that I had written and worked with me. So it was a really special experience with a really prominent American composer at that time.
What was your major instrument?
Trombone.
Trombone. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. And Carol, I didn't realize that you double Grammy. I mean, that I love that. But I was curious about this is the role in the preparation of William Bolcom's The Songs of Innocence and Experience. What's meant by in preparation for that? What was the preparation part?
I helped prepare the chamber choir, which was doing the more difficult music, the more atonal music, as well as the other ensembles that were doing the more traditional choral sounds. And I started to realize how everything was put together early on in the process. And knew that it was going to be spectacular.
Oh, how about that?
For that performance while I was a student at the University of Michigan.
That and a great school for voice and choral studies. William Bolcom, what's that guy like to work with?
He's great. I didn't work with him a lot one-on-one, but he would come to rehearsal and give comments to just the choir and also to the combined forces. He's got a great personality and is interested in so many different kinds of music.
Yeah. When I first moved to town, I had heard about UNCSA being pretty good and the various universities. And I was having a sticky bun at Ollie's Bakery, and the subject of the premiere of The Rite of Spring came up. I was talking with a friend of mine here at school, and he was saying 1913. I think I was saying 1911. And I heard this voice come out. And it was 1913. This older gentleman comes up, and he's just kind of in my face, you know, a little bit. And he said, "You know how I know that?" I said, "No, I don't know that." "My teacher, Darius Milhaud, studied with Igor Stravinsky. My name's Bill Bolcom." He was in town for a premiere of a string quartet, or I can't remember what it was, but it was a new work that he had done, and UNCSA was doing it. And that was my entree to him. And then he proceeded to talk to us for 45 minutes.
I bet he did.
Anyway, Bill Bolcom. Now it's all collage all the time. Talk about the size and the scope of this year's Collage 2012, Carol. What varieties of genres represented?
Our wind ensemble and orchestra and choral ensembles, the large ensembles that sort of make up the backbone of the concert. Mm-hmm. We have Finnish composer Ratovara El Grito from his Suite de Lorca.
Now that's not one that I'm familiar with.
The piece that Ratovara wrote is all poetry by Federico Garcia Lorca. Mm-hmm. And this particular poem, the English translation is The Scream. And Raldivar sets it with a very prominent slide from a low E to a high E, starting out with the women. Tenors join later. Lorca was very connected to Salvador Dalí, and Raldivar's setting of this text, you can make that sort of leap from aural to visual in his sort of surrealistic way that he sets the music with slides down and intricate use of dissonance throughout. Student composition using laptops and manipulating sound. We have African drumming ensemble. This year we're excited to have dance participate, and both performances will use acoustic sound. One of them is Blossom Deary's performance of I Won't Dance, performed by musicians in the School of Music.
I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, don't ask me. I won't dance, monsieur, with you.
And the other is a series of vocalizations by another dancer offstage.
You know what? You're handsome. You know what? Too handsome. But oh, what you do to
lots
me.
Lots of variety in terms of the performance itself, this collage performance. And then this year, you're going to be enhancing it additionally with some lighting or some staging effects. Can we talk about that without giving away the...
I think so. Okay. At the end of the process of collage last year, our technical designer in ACOC Auditorium, James Goins, came to us and he said, you know, if you let me know more in advance, which is the real trick, if you let me know more in advance of what you'd like to do, I can design special lights that would correlate with the specific pieces of music and have images projected around the building and different colors and things like that to really enhance the experience of listening to the music. And just another level of stimulation for the audience to really bring the music into a more vivid light. The School of Music in particular at UNCG has been part of the campus for well over 100 years. So it's one of the oldest schools of music of that type in the state, even back when the school was for women only, which was up until, I guess, the 1960s. And it has a long tradition of piano music and vocal music in particular, and the instrumental side of things actually developed much later, around the time of World War II, when even the UNCG band of all women would go over to Chapel Hill and perform at the football games because all of the men had been drafted to serve in World War II. So the arts have a long and varied presence on our campus.
How big is this thing? How many people are involved?
Just an instrumentalist, there are probably 170 instrumentalists. We have about 150 singers, probably 20 or 30 faculty members. So, I mean, we're well over 300, almost 400 people that are performing that night.
My thanks to University of North Carolina Greensboro School of Music, Theater, and Dance Associate Director of Bands and Director of Orchestral Activities, Kevin Giraldi, and Assistant Professor of Choral Music, Carol Ott. The Collage Concert 2012 begins Saturday, September 8th at 7:30 in ACOC Auditorium on the UNCG campus. Dance, piano, wind, string, vocal, and jazz combo faculty performers, student wind ensemble, orchestra, university chorale, and chamber singers, jazz ensembles, and much more, all live in surround sound like you've never heard it before. You'll find links to ticket information, complete program information, and more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Do you like a good story? Well, who doesn't? Now you're talking the language of my next guest. Jeff Polish spent years doing genetics research, and he eventually went into teaching, but all along the way he maintained a deep love for storytelling. In 2008, Jeff's growing fascination with personal stories told by interesting people led him to form The Monty. It's a nonprofit whose mission is to create community through the telling of stories, from the hilarious to the tragic and everything in between. Each month, Jeff invites ordinary folks to tell their stories without notes in front of an audience. Coming up Friday night, September 14th at 8 o'clock, it's the Monty season opener at the Arts Center in Carrboro. On the bill, Daniel Wallace, Jill McCorkle, Lisa Meacham, and Carter Kirsch. In the meantime, here's Monty founder Jeff Polish.
Before I was a scientist, I was the best storyteller in my group of friends. We all know a person like that. And what I loved about storytelling is that it was a way for me to connect with people in a way that I had never before, because I was a very shy kid growing up. When I went over to college, I realized that people were really compelled by my delivery, and it was just something I adopted as my skill set, if you will. And I don't know, I basically felt like this is something that I always wanted to do. I just didn't know that there was an audience for it. I mean, I knew storytelling is big, but real, compelling storytelling, true stories, I didn't know that people would wanna come to see that.
Growing up, my parents were folk music folks. We'd go to the folk festival. We heard Pete Seeger, Arlo Guthrie. Those were the first storytellers I heard as a 6-7-year-old and thought, wait a minute, something's happening here. You could feel it in the audience. There's just some connection we were all sharing. Was there an early on experience like that for you?
There was, actually. It was in college when I was dragged to see Spalding Gray, one of the greatest monologuists of all time.
The late great.
The late great, exactly. And I didn't know what I was getting into, but he just sat there at a table with some notes, but basically just talking to the audience and telling his stories, which were hilarious. They were filled with angst and pathology. But I thought that this was amazing because I had a lot of angst inside of me too. And I felt like, oh my God, this guy's doing it. He's writing these monologues and he's going from college campus to college campus. I want to do that. But I was a pre-med at the time. I was a scientist. I didn't know what my life would look like if I were to give up everything and move to New York and start doing one-man shows off Broadway. It was scary, so I didn't do it. And it was only 4.5 years ago when I discovered that there was an organization in New York City that was doing just this. They were inviting people to tell true stories in front of an audience, and people were lining up to take up seats in the audience. And I actually went to New York, and I checked it out, and it was incredible. And so I came back to Chapel Hill, and I thought, I'm going to do this here. So I first reached out to a couple people in the area, in the Chapel Hill Triangle area, and people were crazy about it. And a couple months later, I had a show in a back room of a restaurant, and we were turning people away. We had 150 people show up. We only had room for 80, but we squeezed in 30 more, had 110 people, and people loved it. And we've been selling out shows ever since. The formula is very simple. It's so stripped down. There's no gimmicks. It's a person, a microphone, and an audience. And they're telling a very personal, very true, very real story. And who doesn't want to listen to that?
What makes it so compelling? I mean, people love stories.
The reason that we relate to a story that's being told is because it taps into something we've experienced. And if it doesn't do that, if stories don't do that, then we're not going to connect to them. But in reality, there are infinite number of stories that can be told. But really, there are about 10 different stories that all of this great collection of stories fall into. They're different themes.
Give me a few.
Fall from grace or loss of innocence, regaining of innocence. You're falling in love, falling out of love. Man versus nature, man versus man. All these things, it's just struggles against each other and ourselves. And any story that is told falls into these different categories. We had a Sikh tell a story about coming from India and moving to New York City and being scared out of his mind. And he was scared to walk down the streets. He was just, you know, it was a new world for him.
Sikh is part of the Hindu faith?
Right, exactly. So he was scared. You know, he's walking around. He's a stranger in a strange land. And he goes down to Daytona Beach for spring break. And it's this clash of cultures. It's a wonderful story. And I was talking about this. We all can relate to stories. I mean, that's why we like stories. And my wife said, well, I don't know what it's like to be a Sikh in New York City. I can't relate to that, but yet I love that story. And I said, well, you're not relating to the details of that story, but you are relating to the fact that you know what it's like to be new, a stranger in a new place. You went to college and knew nobody. You moved to a new city and knew nobody. You know exactly what that's like, and that's why you love that story so much. And she said, well, yeah, you're right. That's what we're tapping into. What's going on underneath is what we're really tapping into. And that's why stories are so powerful.
As we all know, you can have a great storyline, great subject matter, and it falls flat. What elements make for great storytelling?
This is what I teach in my workshops. And I think that at the core, you have to know what your story is about. You could tell a story about taking your child to a baseball game. And if you don't really know why you're telling that story, it's not really that compelling. But if you know that the reason that you're telling that story is because this trip to the baseball game is just following in a tradition that your father created as a child, you went to baseball games as a child, now the story has relevance, it has impact. And many people who come to me and want to tell stories, they don't understand that there's context that needs to be given to an audience. We need to know that there's a beginning, middle, and end to a story. There's a situation and then there's the story. What is the story really about? It's not about the baseball game. It's about father-son connection.
David Jones is a great storyteller about Sam the snail. Look at that escargot. And it's a long-winded joke. But he took his time. He had it must have been a 15-minute story. And he took so much time in between the words. He's like Miles Davis using this, you know, the silence in between the notes.
Those are very important techniques. You have to use space. When you're trying to emphasize something that's really important, you slow down. You take your time. When you're describing facts or settings, you want to speed up. So those techniques are really important. And as important as what you do say in a story is what you don't say. I don't want to beat people over the head about what I'm trying to say. I want them to be able to infer what I'm saying. This is a literary event, and great storytelling is really about the subtlety.
My thanks to the Monty founder, Jeff Polish. Coming up Friday night, September 14th at 8, it's the Monty season opener at the Arts Center in Carrboro. On the bill will be Daniel Wallace, Jill McCorkle, Lisa Meacham, and Carter Kirsch. You'll find links to more information along with several storytelling samples at wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, that's all for today's program. Our senior producer is Catherine Mobley, and our audio engineer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find links to more information about all of the arts organizations and events we've covered today on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today for Triad Arts Up Close.